Succession is a byproduct of management, and bad management is why succession is a problem today. Most firms are built like a puzzle, and the picture makes sense when everybody's there.
Back with more Future Proof, friends, and welcome. I'm your host, Bill Sheridan. And today we're going to talk about nothing less than the future of our profession. Pretty deep stuff there, but pretty important too, given what's happening in the world around us. But first, let me start this week's show with the fact that it is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So, listen, the accounting and finance profession, as we know it, seems to be under assault. Right? New technology, staggering legislation and regulations, demographic shifts that are reshaping the face of the workforce. We're experiencing change and complexity on a level we've never seen before, really. Or is that really true? I mean, in a way, when you think about it, none of what we're experiencing right now is new. All of the thought leaders out there are calling this the fourth industrial revolution. So, know what that means? There have been three other industrial revolutions before it. We've gone through massive change before, right? The first industrial revolution, of course, in the 18th and 19th centuries in Europe and North America, was a period when mostly farm-based rural societies became industrial and urban. The iron and textile industries, along with the development of the water wheel and then the steam engine, played central roles in that revolution. The second industrial revolution between 1870 and 1914, right, just before World War I, that was a period of growth for industries like steel, oil, electricity, and we used electric power to create mass production, right? Major technological advances included the telephone, the light bulb, phonograph, the internal combustion engine. Pretty big stuff going on there. And then came the third industrial revolution, or the digital revolution. That's the advancement of technology from analog, electric, and mechanical devices to the digital technology that's available today. That era started in the 1980s. Of course, we saw the PC, the internet, information and communications technologies, huge advances there. Which brings us to today, right? The fourth industrial revolution, which is basically the digital revolution. Robotics, AI, nanotechnology, quantum computing, biotechnology, the Internet of Things, decentralized consensus, 3D printing, autonomous vehicles, huge advances that are reshaping our world. So yeah, we've been through massive change before, you know, eras in which we've had to transform our business models to kind of dovetail with the changes of the day. The only difference today is that these changes are happening faster than ever before, which means that we have to be more nimble and ready to shift with the next big transformation, which is probably coming right around the corner, right? And that, in part, is Bill Reeb's message to the accounting and finance world. Bill is chief executive of the management consulting firm Succession Institute, LLC. But more importantly, he's the incoming chair of the American Institute of CPAs. And he has a message for members of our rarefied profession. That message is, forget what you know, right? The world's a different place. In fact, he has four pieces of advice for today's accounting and finance professional. These come straight from the AICPA. I quote, number one, let go of what you think you know. Bill Reeb is a martial arts black belt. He says, martial arts are big on humility, and accountants should be too. Part of that involves rigorously re-examining past lessons and work methods to see if they still hold true in a time of great change. Message number two, accept that technical aptitude alone will not be enough. Familiarity with technology, continued improvement in human skills, like critical thinking, judgment, leadership, will also define accounting professionals in the future. Here's what he says. He says, this powerful combination of our technical expertise, technological understanding, and enhanced human skills are foundational to positioning ourselves, rather, for a brighter future. Message number three, he says, challenge what it means to be an accountant. That means providing higher value strategic guidance in core service areas such as audit, tax, and finance, broadening tax practices to meet the growing need for a more integrated life planning approach for individuals, and extending assurance into emerging areas such as cybersecurity risk management, sustainability, supply chain. And then there's his fourth message, which is simply embrace a disruptive mindset. I guess there's really nothing simple about that. He says, we need to shift our thinking from what our profession is and what we do today to what our profession should be and what we need to be doing tomorrow. So really excited to have Bill Reeb as my guest on this week's show. He's outspoken, he's opinionated, he's not afraid to say what he thinks. That alone is reason enough to sit down with him, but he's also passionate about the profession and its future. And today we need someone like that ready to lead us into an exciting and uncertain tomorrow. So good stuff here. Here's my conversation with new AICPA chair, Bill Reeb.
Where are you from originally, Bill?
Well, my mom was a salmon. And
a salmon, you're going to have to define that for me.
Well, you know, the fish.
Uh-huh.
So as salmon spawn, they go upstream to birth.
Okay.
To the same place. So my dad was military, so no matter where we were in the world, she went back to the same place to birth all the boys.
Which was?
Lockhart, Texas.
Texas.
Lockhart, Texas. It's a bedroom community of Austin. It's where her mom and dad were. And so she not only went there, but her sister's husband gave birth to all of us. He was a doctor.
Your dad was military? Is that right? Kind of moved
33
around?
33 years, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Chief Warrant Officer.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have one older, one younger, and one sister who's the youngest.
Is it true what they say about Texas? Everything's bigger there?
No, just our egos and our interpretations. I live on the water. It's called Lake Austin. And the bizarre thing is that it wouldn't even be considered a creek in North Carolina.
No.
So
no.
We make everything sound bigger. It actually is not bigger.
Right. Right. So Austin's kind of home base now at this point? Or?
I live, for anybody that's in the tax practice, I live at least 6 months in one day in Austin, Texas. And I live the other 5 months in Breckenridge, Colorado.
In Colorado.
Stay there in the summer to get away from the heat, and then we ski a little bit.
There you go. All right. It's funny. I see lists come out at least 2-3 times a year about the fastest growing cities in America, and Austin is always at or near the top. So it sounds like you've been there, or at least partially been there for your entire life. Is that true? I mean,
I would say partially been there my entire life, yes.
How is it different today from when you were growing up?
People.
Yeah.
Too many people.
Too many people.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had Austin is a blue city in a red state. You know, mm-hmm. The state will probably at some point turn blue.
But I live in St. Louis, same thing.
Yeah. So, but the issue is that we had a philosophy that as a city that if we don't build it, they won't come. And that never works that way. So they didn't build the roads thinking that would keep people away. So now we actually have very high growth, but we were tagged recently as one of the top 5 worst cities per capita to drive in.
Oh, really?
Because there's virtually no east-west corridors to drive in.
Uh-huh.
And the north-south ones are so overloaded. So it is a struggle to drive in Austin, which is another reason why we love Breckenridge, because it takes me 10 minutes to get out of my neighborhood. You can't actually buy anything even in that 10 minutes. There is no retail. There's no nothing. So it's about 20 minutes to get to somewhere you can buy something. And in Breckenridge, I can circle the town 3 times in 20 minutes and go to 10 different stores. Probably. Well, that's an exaggeration. But the point is, everything's about 5 minutes or 3 minutes away. So
yeah.
It's really fantastic.
A little bit better. So why accounting, Bill? What drew you to the profession?
Well, I started out in sales with IBM. And what I found was that I truly enjoyed the aspect of the advice side. So as I would be installing big pieces of equipment in manufacturing and construction, and we'd be talking about how to implement MRP or capacity planning or how we're going to do a better job in building our homes or whatever it was, those are the discussions I liked. I had those discussions because they were part of determining equipment size, applications, et cetera. But it was the management side that I loved. And so after a couple of years, I decided that I wanted to leave IBM and start my own business. I took a couple of people with me from IBM, and we started a technology company. And what we did was go in and work with companies to implement various technologies. So in my first two jobs, my first job was a full year assignment with Westinghouse. My second job was with Abbott Laboratories. And I think Abbott Laboratories still uses, and this was probably 30-something years ago, so they still use in a couple of their plants the stuff that I designed that long ago.
That's nice.
But the job of implementing systems, one was a job cost system where Westinghouse built motors bigger than this room. And they're on a standard cost system. And the government said, if you want to keep building motors for us, you have to go to an actual cost system. So designing the software to be able to handle that was my job. And when I took the job, I thought it was predominantly a gig about managing a software team. Well, they had great software developers. What it turned out was my job was to interface between the VP of manufacturing, the controller, the CEO, all of those things, and try to get everybody to come to consensus. And invariably, I'd work with the CPA, the CFO, and I'd end up working with their consultants that they'd bring in, which were usually large firm consultants. And at that time, they didn't really do a lot of technology work. So whether it was Abbott or whether it was Westinghouse, they didn't do a lot of The CPAs didn't do a lot of technology consulting, but they still brought them in. So I was working for CPAs, which were the CFOs, doing work with advisors that were CPAs. And that's when I decided, you know, the handwriting's pretty clear here. If you're going to be giving advice, you better have those three letters behind your name. Mm-hmm. So I went back to school and I joined a CPA firm to get my experience. And when I finished with that, I split off and started my own firm.
Yeah, yeah. And you've been, I mean, it seems like the one thing that I see attached to your name more than anything over the last 5, 10, 15 years even is succession. How did that come about? Why that niche?
Well, when you look at the baby boom generation, succession is a problem. There's a lot of us going out at one time.
Yes.
And that creates a management problem. But I can tell you the first book I wrote on succession, PCPS, called me and said, we'd like for you to write a book for us. And I said, okay. I said, I'm happy to do that. But if I do, then succession will be the last chapter. Mm-hmm. I said, the rest of it's all about running a firm. I said, succession's easy. It's just not easy when you don't do the things you need to be doing. So succession is the spotlight that shows the cracks in all the management and all the operations. Mm-hmm. If you're developing people, you don't have competency gaps, you've got the right kind of compensation system, you have the right kind of hierarchy, the right kind of accountability, you have the right kind of commitment to development, the right kind of commitment to bringing in enough people, the right kind of marketing focus, the right, all of those things make succession really easy. Succession is not a problem. Succession is a problem when you choose to do things, I don't want to say inefficiently. It's actually efficiently that's the key word here.
It's like a mark on you as a leader.
Almost. Well, succession, not being ready for succession, is a mark on you. And what I'm trying to say is if we in this room were a team and we knew each other's skills, then we could build an operation around the three of us that would be very efficient, leveraging your strengths, minimizing your weaknesses, leveraging my strengths, weaknesses, et cetera. So as we do that, that would be very effective. But as soon as you pull one of us out of the equation, it's not effective anymore. Because we didn't actually say, you have a role, fill the role. I have a role, fill the role. We simply said, hey, wait a second. Do whatever you want. And we'll build around it. That's why when you look at most sports teams that have a very winning record can't make it to the finals. Why? Because they have built that team specifically around two or three players. Mm-hmm. And when invariably one of those players is down, the team is no longer effective. Mm-hmm. And what succession means is that we develop around roles, we develop around competencies, we develop around expectations, and we hold people accountable. And when you do that, then you can take someone out and put someone else in because they're filling a role. We don't build this around Bill. We don't build this around you and say, okay, here's what your skills are, so build around you. And then when somebody replaces you, we don't go out and find another you.
It's about the seat and who's capable of filling that
about that seat. And yeah. So here's what a conversation I have with a lot of firms, and they start talking about managing partners. They say, who's the right managing partner? I said, you don't bring in a managing partner that's like the other managing partner. There's a role here to fill. Mm-hmm. Whoever is tagged with filling that role has to conform to that role. They don't make it up. Yeah. Do the job. Right. And I've had people say, well, I don't want to do that job. And I say, then pull your name out of the list for running for the managing partner. This isn't yours to build around you. This is yours to fill. Which, by the way, the single most common question I get is, so what's your plan as chair? And what are you going to do? What's your specific initiatives? And my answer is always the same one. I'm chair of the board. I don't have specific initiatives. We have a strategic plan. And my job is, I was involved in working on it last year, and I'm going to be involved in continuing it this year. And if something happens where the strategic plan gets out of whack with what the environment is, then we'll look at changing the strategic plan. This isn't about me. This mm-hmm. is about what we see as the strategy and making sure that we're putting our resources behind the strategy. There isn't. The minute you start having chairs that say, well, this is what I'm going to do as chair, well, then you're building an organization around each individual. And each individual comes in and says, well, here's what I want to do. Well, I don't care what you want to do. What do we want to do?
Right.
That's what matters.
Yeah.
What did we decide to do with our resources? It's not about an individual chair to reroute the effort. It's about staying on course.
Yep.
So a good sign of a chair is when you can come in and go out and you don't miss a beat. A good sign of a good leader is when you can come in and go out and you don't miss a beat. A good sign of a leader is when I can step down and whoever takes my place is better than me mm-hmm. because they are filling the role in a better way.
Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of people that actually take pride that when they step down, they're missed. Mm-hmm. And that is a sign of poor leadership.
Right.
Because if we miss you, you've built an organization around you to leverage your strengths, and we could not build something around that.
Yeah.
And so we are in pain. And if you weren't that good, then we wouldn't have done that. I say in my speeches often, I make the comment, if the only person you can develop is yourself, then you're of limited value, but you've got to be able to develop others. But I also make the comment that is around the idea that the minute you become too important, the better you are, let me say it this way, the stronger you are, the weaker the organization. And people will say, oh, come on, Bill, that is garbage. The stronger you are as an individual, the weaker the organization. How can that possibly be true? Don't we want the strongest people we can get? And the answer is no. I want strong people, but I want them to leverage their strengths. So I want them to help use those strengths to make other people better. But if you're so good that you're the only one that can do this, or you're so good that you can handle volumes of work more than anybody else can, then we get comfortable under-resourcing whatever it is. We get comfortable not having the right kind of talent, building the right kind of competencies to replace you because we go, well, nobody can replace you. And when you're gone, we're hurting.
Right.
Succession is a byproduct of management. And bad management is why succession is a problem today.
Yeah.
Most firms are built like a puzzle. And the picture makes sense when everybody's there. I do a lot of training of young partners and managers, and it's interesting because one of the key things I talk about is the message I just gave you offends a lot of people. I'm known for offending a lot of people. That's actually where I thought you were going with your reputation and procedure. But I also tell them, look, the firms you guys are with are successful. You consider you know, 580 firms out of 44,000 have more than 21 people. You're in a firm with more than 21 people. You're the best of the best. Mm-hmm. You're in tall cotton, as we might say in Texas. Mm-hmm. So this isn't about those firms being wrong. This isn't about that. So I said, when you as managers and young partners want to say, well, we got to fix this, I said, what you need to lead with is not we got to fix this. What you need to lead with is, by the way, this works really well for you guys and gals. But as soon as a couple of you leave, we are not in a position with what's following us to step into your role. You've mm-hmm. built this like a puzzle and you are very successful. But we can't be very successful because we aren't the combination of pieces mm-hmm. that you will have missing. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes a much more palatable message for change is, okay, this isn't you telling me I'm wrong and I don't know what I'm doing, because how can I be wrong and not know what I'm doing when we've never had a more successful firm in the history of our firm? So how can that be wrong?
Right.
It's not wrong. It's that as that business transitions to the next generation, they did not set the next generation in a position for succession. Mm-hmm. They did not set them up to win, to succeed. They set them up to fail. Mm-hmm. So that's my key on succession. Succession is a no-brainer if you manage the practice right. So when it comes to what we do in succession, it's all about best practices of business. And the reason why we chose Succession Institute is because that is the weakest link in most organizations, is that they're focusing on efficiency today instead of the investments they need to make a more effective long-term organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if we are talking about the succession of, I don't know, the profession, for instance. I mean, when you accepted the role as AICPA chair, you said the role accountants play as trusted advisors has never been more important. So, I mean, why is that true?
Well, it's true because two things are going on. One is most of our firms, probably 60, 70% of our work is the commodity work, and much of that commodity work is the simple commodity work. Mm. And when you consider one, technology and the way it is taking over that low-end work. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago when we used to go to the bank to deposit a check. Well, you take pictures of them today. We forget how much has changed day in, day out, because it's like watching your dog grow. You see your dog every day and it grows every day, but because you're with it every day, it doesn't seem like much has changed. But when you step back and reflect, we've had a lot of change. Well, you look at something like TurboTax, and for $30, you can get a CPA to review it.
Right.
I don't know any CPA firms that can review a tax return for $30. The environment is changing. And if you want to take where we've got firms that are 60, 70% compliance-based, with much of it being simple complexity, it's like a cliff we're driving at. We're like Thelma and Lee's. We're just driving as fast as we can. Looks like a beautiful view, and that thing's just going to fall right off. So if you don't embrace the consulting side, if you don't embrace the advisory side, that doesn't mean that you run away from compliance. It means that we will hold on to the more complex compliance. But if you don't embrace that, then you will be replaced by bots and software. And if you're not, you'll be replaced by globalization, because you can get someone in India or China to do that work for 20, 25 cents on the dollar, and that's all in.
Yeah.
So if I can get somebody for 25 cents on the dollar to do it, and they do it as well, then why would I be able, how can I take the economics we built this organization on and make any money? And how can it sustain itself?
Yeah.
Most firms, when somebody comes in and underbids them by 50%, for decades has said, well, they're just trying to buy the business. They'll probably go out of business and then we'll come back in. That was true 20 years ago. It probably was true 10 years ago. It became less true 5 years ago, and it's probably not true at all today, because that person that comes in and bids 50 cents on the dollar is probably using outsourced labor from India. They're probably using more technology, and that 50 cents on the dollar isn't them saying, I will do this for nothing. It's them using a different way to deliver it.
Right.
And the firm that's competing with them is still stuck in the old way, saying, this is the how we've done it. This is how we've done it for 50 years. We've been successful, and we've been more successful now than we ever have. So why would we change something that's not broken?
Mm-hmm.
So in my inauguration mm-hmm. speech, I said, our profession has to look at, yeah, I get that it's not broke, But we can see the cracks, and we need to break it before those cracks become problematic for us. We need to make sure that that road Thelma and Louise are on isn't a cliff, but in fact, there's a bridge there that helps us get to a better place. And the fact is, we already have a trusted advisor perception. We already have clients in the world thinking we're trusted advisors. So move into the space that's higher valued. You'll still be able to pull some of the compliance work with you, and we'll have an even better and brighter future. But if you want to dig your head in the sand and say, it's not happening, it won't happen here, it won't happen in my town, that may happen in the big cities, then you're kidding yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I talked to a business expert a couple of years ago, Rita McGrath, who said, kind of answering that argument, you know, you'll continue to make money right up until the day that you don't. And then what are you going to do, right? So, and I think that's kind of what we're talking about here. It's you know.
You're going to drive off a cliff. And,
that's
you
right.
know, if you run a two-person shop and you're going to retire in 5 years, then drive on.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You're fine. But if you actually have people that work for you and you want to provide them with a living and you want them to have something to continue, and that's probably the biggest point I try to make to anybody I talk to. I spend a lot of time in change management. And the first place we go to when you start talking about change, we're humans that have big egos. And when you start telling me I got to change, my first position is, okay, what are you telling me I'm doing wrong? And why do you know more than me? And why do you think something that's working is wrong? And so I become defensive and I start saying, wait a second, you must not know what you're talking about because I can't be wrong. It's working.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to recognize is that the changes we're talking about making are changes so that the generation behind us has a profession and the generation behind them has a profession. We've been around for a long time. And that's because there were leaders in front of us that said, you know something, this may not be the best thing for me, but it's the best thing for us. And when you take the me out of the equation, the answers are pretty simple. But as soon as you add the me back in there, because the me is fearful, the me is ego-driven, and the me says, well, wait a second, how am I going to make a living in that space? And how is this going to affect me? And I'd much rather fight for the fact that you're wrong and I don't have to do this than admit that I might be in a position where I and my value is starting to fade if I stay the course. And the answer I'm going to give to all of our professionals is we got time to change. But we got time to change if we change now. We do not have time to sit and say, let me wait another 3 or 4 years and we'll size this up. We are going to miss that opportunity to build that bridge and we are going to fall off a cliff. And that doesn't mean we all fall off a cliff, but I'm saying when you talk about a profession that's just been growing and prospering and more trust than we've ever had and better quality, we just keep moving forward and you take that. And then we have some people saying, nope, got to protect this thing. And we become very defensive. Then what we've left behind is going to be a shrinking profession. And I'm sure it'll still do fine. But it won't. We haven't left our younger people with the same ability to make a living that someone before us gave to us. And I just don't think that's right.
So assuming that we all see the change that you're seeing and understand the need to evolve and actually start doing it at a pace that will keep us, you know, at least abreast with the changes that are happening. What does the future of this profession look like to you?
Well, every profession, every learned profession is going to be a technology-driven profession. I comment all the time. I talk about it at council. I was skiing with a young man and I asked him, I said, so what do you do? And he said, I didn't know he's a young man. You can't tell when they're on a ski chair. They could be 20, they could be 90. So I said, so what do you do? He said, well, I'm going to Annapolis. I said, so what branch of the military have you chosen? He said, I want to be a Marine. So first thing everybody corrects me is he going to Annapolis. There's only one thing he could be. No, he could be a Marine or he could go in the Navy.
Right.
And he said, I want to be a Marine. I said, what are you going to study? He said, it doesn't matter. I can pick any field. They're all the same. They all start with technology. You can't do anything without technology. I mean, the think about it. The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the military of the future may never leave their seat. never leave a desk. They may never, you may have wars that are fought with no one there, with the person protected because it's done by technology. All technology. I'm just saying the world is a fast-changing pace. So if you start saying that technology is part of everything, it's the lead in everything, whether you want to be a doctor, or an engineer, or a lawyer, technology is going to be part of that. Our profession is going to be based on technology. Not because we're going to become software developers, but because you can't do the work without integrating all of these massive technology changes into it. So I see the CPA of the future being very technology-centric, very technology-based. I see a lot of technologists in our future. I see a lot of accountants in our future that would come more from a traditional accounting. I see a blending of that. But I don't see it ending there. I see as we evolve as a society and as technology continues to evolve, there will be other skill sets that will become required for what we do. And what we have to learn is we have to learn that, yes, the profession was defined this way. But if we want to continue to manage the space we manage, if we want to continue to deliver value to our clients, we've got to embrace the competencies we need to be able to deliver on that. Now, I'm not saying every single person that works in a CPA firm needs to be a CPA. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying the core of what we do, we need to embrace. We need to not alienate. We need to bring together the basic skill sets of people that are required to do what we do. Which leads me to the issue that's big in our discussions now. It's the CPA evolution space. The CPA evolution space is one of, if the audit today is becoming more and more technology-based. If the new DAS project, Dynamic Audit Solution, is going to incorporate more AI, blockchain, more technology. If we're elevating the audit space, the attest space, the assurance space, to incorporate more technology. And the future of that space says that technologists have to be able to look at it. Today, we tend to audit around the computer. If you're a big firm, you'll have technologists involved in the audit. If you're a smaller firm, you'll pretty much audit around the technology. But we are building more and more technology into our processes. And as we do that, we have to have more and more technologists. And if we don't embrace the group, and I'm not talking about software developers, I'm not talking about gamers, I'm talking about people that are in data analytics, I'm talking about people in the system process, the ones that are looking and inside the systems and saying, okay, let's look at blockchain. Let's see if that blockchain is valid. Because if we don't have those kinds of skills, we can't do the audit. And I am fearful, and I can see, I can picture a conversation happening in Congress where I've got a group of technologists saying, hey, by the way, 7 years from now, we can do the audit without an accountant because we know accounting, but they can't do it without us. So why do they have a protected space of assurance? Why do they legislatively only have the rights to do it? Because they can't do it without us. Mm-hmm. So the pushback, and by the way, you know, we're in lockstep with NASBA, ASCPA leadership. NASBA leadership is in lockstep. We have people from the state boards that don't like it. We have members that don't like it. We have a lot of pushback. Change always creates pushback.
Sure.
We have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We have a once-in-a-lifetime. If we miss this, then that assurance side is at risk, and we may not be able to claw it back because the change we're talking about will take many years to put in place. If we don't start now, then we won't be there quick enough to avoid that conversation. And if that conversation happens, it'll be too late. We won't be able to say, but wait, give us 5 more years. We'll fix this. Won't happen. So we have to think ahead, and we have to think about where are we going and how we're going to get there. And we've got to think about not me, but we've got to think about what's the best thing for the profession. Now, if our big firms already have a bunch of technologists in an audit, and we are redesigning the audit and the framework to build more technology into the process, how can you go forward and say, we don't need that skill set?
Right.
Well, then the next response is, well, let's just make all the CPAs become technologists. Well, we already have 150 hours that people are fighting over. We already have an issue that says, okay, I have to do this much more to become a CPA. So now we want all the people to go through an accounting curriculum and then go through a full technology curriculum. Well, that's a way to make sure nobody becomes a CPA because the hurdle to get there is just too big.
Yeah.
So we have to find a way to embrace the people that are already practicing in this space. And yes, over time, if you fast forward 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now, I think what comes out is a very sophisticated technologist that's an accountant. But we can't get there without bridging them in. And we can't get there without pulling these skill sets in. Because to turn to our members who are accountants and say, become a technologist, it's just, that's not where their passion is. It's not what they want to do.
No. So like Joe or Jane CPA, who's running their firm or organization and just heads down trying to get through, you know, a day that seems busier than ever before, what would you say they need to start doing tomorrow to prepare for that type of thing?
Well, in this case, you're probably talking about a smaller firm, and audit may or may not be part of their skill set. I mean, there's 44,000 firms. We have 14,000 that participate in the assurance world. So a lot of our firms don't participate in that. I would tell you that there is no firm, none, that shouldn't embrace the idea that they've got to become advisors. Every single person, not, okay, Bill, you'll be the advisor, and then the rest of us will be technical people. Every one of the partners and every one of the managers, if you want that kind of role, you have to start building client relationships and you have to start providing advice. I don't care that you can't walk into a conference room and go up and meet everybody. I'm not turning people into salespeople. I'm simply saying that everybody in the highest level positions has to learn how to provide advice. And that is to have conversations with their clients about where they're trying to go and how they want to get there. And that is not an option, in my opinion, because if you don't, you are going to be one of the many firms in the Thelma and Louise example that simply runs out of road. And they'll be doing fine and fine and just like the dog growing a little bit, and it's kind of a strange analogy, but a little bit of business will fall away and fall away and fall away. So they won't see it because it's trickling. Mm-hmm. And then one day they'll look and say, what just happened?
Right.
Now, unlike the dog growing, it's getting bigger. But I'm giving the reverse of that. It's shrinking and they don't see it. And then all of a sudden they go, what happened to our business? Because it simply dwindles and then falls off.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it is no longer profitable enough to make it work.
Bill Rabe, thanks. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Bill.
That was Bill Rabe, chair of the 2019-2020 Board of Directors of the American Institute of CPAs. You can follow all the disruptive fun at AICPA.org, MACPA.org, and BLIonline.org. And remember, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning. That's it, gang. Have a great week.